You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev. How are you, Anne?
Kev, I'm great. And hello to our lovely listener who I'm sure is listening either on the podcast or live now.
Yeah.
I haven't seen you in a while, Kev.
Yeah, well.
You've been very quiet. I tried to rage bait you last night with a text from Jim Chalmers, our treasurer, but you didn't really bite.
Well, you know, well, yeah, I've been working rather hard. But he's Dr. Jim Chalmers, right? He's a very intelligent man by the looks of his resume, and we can tell that he's got a fine mind. How come he doesn't understand the basics of the monetary system?
He was trying to tell us that paying down the debt is a good thing. Oh well.
Yeah, doing the old debt to GDP ratio thing.
The other thing I've noticed lately in the news is these reports about the first time that a particular strain of bird flu has arrived in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And so far it's just a handful of wild birds apparently. But they're a bit worried about this particular strain because it's known to spread easily from birds to other animals and to humans.
Yep.
All it would take is one sick bird that goes undetected and this thing could just take off through the continent like wildfire. And I was thinking, as I was listening to this report, that is like a lot of shoreline in Western Australia to monitor for birds.
I don't think they can. I think they can only monitor what they can monitor.
They can only do what they can do. But then I was thinking, okay, what if somebody offered you a job at around $50,000 a year to wander around the beaches of Western Australia?
Yeah.
And they gave you a bit of training to detect sick birds and what to do with them?
And you could do other things as well. And you could surf in between if you needed to get out a bit further to get a bit of a view.
Hmm. So do you reckon that's something that you could see people taking on?
Oh, yeah, I could do that.
So, of course, that's my way of saying that one of my favourite pastimes is to try and imagine what might make a good job guarantee job.
Yeah.
And so we will be hearing a little bit more about the job guarantee coming up in the show. And today we are returning to our conversation with labour market political sociologist Dr. Victor Quirk. And this is a conversation about the political aspects of full employment, which is inspired by a paper written by economist Mikhail Kolekski back in 1943. And you can find the first part of this two-part conversation in our previous episode 77, wherever you get your podcasts. And, of course, in the first part of our conversation, we quickly realised that mass unemployment, it's not an unfortunate happenstance. It's not the fault of the individual unemployed worker. And instead, we were looking at unemployment as a battleground in class warfare. And today we are going to go back to the turn of the previous century and we're going to look at how this battle played out when Australia was under the thumb of the British Empire and how some of the players in that game were the London bankers and what they had to do with creating unemployment in Australia. And then we will turn to the fair and humane solution, the job guarantee, which is a solution that, of course, gets ignored by both government and business to this day.
And well, there are unionists for a job guarantee floating around the place who are promoting this within the labour ranks. So let's see how that goes.
We'll see how that goes. In the meantime, let's have a listen to our conversation with Dr. Victor Quirk.
go back to various instances in history where, in anticipation of a major industrial dispute, unemployment was deliberately pushed up. And the classic example is in the 1889.
Okay, we're going way back.
1889, there was the London dock strike. And the poorest workers in London were the dock workers, the casual dock workers. And their day started, they turn up outside this gate at the crack of dawn, and the gate would fly open, and there'd be a guy in a cage about 50 yards inside the yard, and they'd all have to sprint to this cage, and this guy would be standing there holding these paper tickets inside this cage, and they'd have to fight and push each other around to try and get a ticket. And if you got a ticket, you could then walk over to the next gate and get a day's work on the docks.
This is like a literal version of musical chairs.
Pretty much. And so you could imagine what the chances would be of organising a union under those conditions. But what happened was a family of them just decided that they're going to organise a union. And they organised a union. They got talking to the other waterside workers and said, you know, we're going to do this. And they went on strike.
Well, so the guy in the cage that opened the gate, and they just, what, didn't turn up?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. Ran to the cage.
Yeah. And so their campaign was to raise their incomes from 5 pence an hour to 6 pence an hour. It might have been 5 pence a day to 6 pence a day.
1 cent a day.
It amounted to something like a 20% increase in pay, you know, but it's like a penny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they went on strike, and everyone just thought this was going to be a joke, because the way that employers sort of dealt with most strikes back in those days is they just sat back and waited for them to starve until they came, you know, cap in hand.
Starve them into submission.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happened then was that the more aristocratic workers amongst the waterside community, the stevedores, who were these skilled workers that knew how to stack a ship so it would stay, you know, balanced, and other high-skilled workers, they all went out on strike in sympathy.
Yes.
And it sort of shut down the London docks, you know, the most crucial port in England.
Mm.
So the wharf owners just sat back and said, all right, we'll just wait for them to come back. Anyway, the strike sort of dragged on for a little while, and then they were running out of strike funds. They couldn't sustain it. And they were having a meeting in this shed one night, the organising committee, and they decided that they're going to have to pack it in and ask for their jobs back because they've run out of funds. But what they didn't know was on the other side of the world, in Brisbane, the wharfies heard about this story and passed around the hat. Then the news of that happening spread all down the east coast of Australia, and so there was this massive flooding of funds, strike funds, to these waterside workers from Australia.
International solidarity.
£36,000. And the most amazing thing was football fixtures handed over their gate takings, the Salvation Army War Cry magazine, they donated all the funds from that. The Lord Mayors of Melbourne and Sydney held benefit concerts. I mean, it's hard to understand how something like this happened.
That's astounding, yeah.
And it has been the subject of some academic sort of speculation. What I believe is happening is that this was in the early days of the cable news services, and so news of this dispute would come from England by sort of telegraph. It would then get distributed to all the different media outlets, so that they could put their own slant on the story. So it was very even-handed reporting. It showed you both sort of sides of the dispute, including talking about the hardships that the waterfront workers were facing. So the Australian newspapers, the mainstream papers, didn't understand that they were getting a pretty unvarnished account. And they published all these stories straight up.
Mm.
And that's what moved people.
Mm.
And so, so all this money arrives, and they basically could have kept the waterfront shut down for the next 3 years on the basis of the money. So the waterfront operators were forced to concede and they actually won the dispute.
So it just comes down to a war of attrition, who can last it out. And whoever's got the best resources will win, essentially.
Yeah. So then when the British business community were reflecting on what just happened, because there were these festivals held up and down England singing the praises of Australia.
Mm-hmm. This is in the late 1880s.
This is 1889.
Right.
Very specifically. And there were speeches made, and the speeches were that from here on in, the international labour movement will stand up for each other. When the Australians are copying it in the neck from their employers, we will support them just as they have done it for us.
Wow.
And, of course, the business community, written up in the Times, they talked about we need to be thinking about what the consequences of this are and where this could lead. And so the British business owners who owned all these businesses in Australia, you know, the major agricultural companies, that were all owned by British owners, they were furious with their managers and they were furious at this idiot middle class in Australia that allowed this to happen, that were actually helping them. The banks were sending the money over free of charge by, you know, it was like a weird, very weird moment. But so now they said, so why has this happened in Australia and particularly Melbourne? £22 million came from Melbourne. And the reason that it happened in Melbourne was that from the mid-1880s, there had been a proto-Keynesian economy operating in Melbourne.
Who knew? Okay.
So basically it was a bunch of crooked land speculators that were in Parliament. And they had this racket going. They would quietly buy up a stack of land outside of Melbourne. Then the government would go over to England and borrow money to build a railway line. They would then put a railway line out to it, subdivide it and sell it off and make a mozza. And these were the land boomers. This premier guy was Duncan Gillies. His name's not well remembered, but we should, because he was a bit of a scoundrel by the sound of it. Now, what happened was they built these railways. Well, back in the day, we didn't have lots of heavy machinery. This was very labour-intensive. So this was employment for people, pick and shovel work, laying train lines and tram lines out, you know, through Brunswick, out to Coburg and all the rest of it. All of this land was opened up with train lines and tramways. And so these people then went into shops and ordered stuff.
So all this skullduggery, I've heard about this before, about all the dodgy land deals that were done and then the railways would go out. And I always just thought to myself, these opportunists and insider trading, really.
Yeah.
But a consequence of that was that it generated an enormous amount of activity for ordinary people, for ordinary workers, yeah?
Absolutely. And they got these loans pretty easily because they would turn up in London and there were all these different financial houses in the City of London. And this was a government borrowing the money. You know, it was guaranteed. There wasn't any risk to it at all, really. But the investments were generating high levels of economic activity in Melbourne. Melbourne was booming. So in other parts of the British Empire, they were going through recessions and depressions. And here was this one spot on the globe that was positively booming, and it was because of this land racket.
Marvellous Melbourne.
Yeah. You know, we'd had the 1880 exhibition where they built the exhibition buildings for.
Yep.
And there was another big international exposition in 1888. So Melbourne was kicking along. That's why all of these working class people were all cashed up and didn't think anything about chipping in a few pounds, a few quid for their cousins back in England. So one of the reasons why this thing happened with the London dock strike was because these financiers in England, out of their own greed, had been pumping money into Melbourne and they realised what they'd done.
There's karma for you. Yeah.
The very next visit from the Victorian government to get money to build another railway, they stopped it. There was a shutdown of the rail building in Melbourne, and by the middle of 1890, so literally 6 months afterwards, we're seeing the signs of growing unemployment. And while all this was happening, there were deals being done all up and down the east coast of Australia to sign up businesses in what's known as intersectoral lockout agreements. Now, these were a common feature in Britain, so that the problem that you have if you're running a business and you want to lock out your workers over an industrial dispute is that all their friends and neighbours and relatives will be taking food into them and looking after them. And so in some places, you might have a strike in one factory. The workers will stick it out for a long time because they're getting that support from all their friends and relatives. Then they'll win that one. So then they have a strike at the neighbouring factory. So what you do is businesses in a district agree that if one of them cops a strike, all of them will lock out all their workers.
Solidarity amongst businesses.
One out all that, but in reverse, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And this is so whole districts would be punished if one group of people went on strike. So they had these lockout agreements and they would go across different sectors. So the wharf operators and the mill operators and the coal miners. So what happened in this period while the unemployment was growing in Melbourne during 1890 is that these guys, a couple of businessmen, were going up and down the East Coast signing up intersectoral lockout agreements. So then they tried a few different ways to spark an industrial dispute and finally did it because the maritime officers in Melbourne wanted to affiliate with Trades Hall and their owners threatened to sack them if they did. And that was the start of the maritime strike. And it was really a lockout. It triggered all the pre-organised intersectoral lockout agreements that shut down whole regions of the east coast of Australia. So that was the Great Maritime Strike, that was 1890. Then there was the Shearers Strike, so it sort of was a rolling thing. And then there was another Shearers Strike, and these all happened in the early 1890s. And they basically decimated the existing trade union movement. The early Australian trade union movement was just trying to get to the stage where it was a legitimate force in the community, that it was allowed to organise and negotiate with employers and things like that.
They play a hard game, don't they? It's like the capitalists will take a hit on their profits in order to, as you say, decimate the opposition.
And I guess they're better resourced to do it. So if push comes to shove, like they're using union tactics to beat the unions, which is to say that they're forming unions of employers and saying, well, yep, if we're going to starve them out, we'll starve them out en masse. And we need to do this in a coordinated and united fashion. And I guess if you're a firm, you're going to have more resources, more ways of lasting it out. So they just increase scale until they win.
Well, it was this sort of level of brutality. So out of the ashes of these disputes that fairly well wrecked the trade union movement as it existed then, the ALP formed. They realised that in all these disputes, government agencies were used against them. The troops were sent in and all sorts of things happened. And so that's what prompted the formation of the Australian Labor Party.
Mm. But they realised that if they're going to have real power, they couldn't just be unions. They had to have some way of being in government or challenging government within the political framework to have real power.
And then, you know, by the late 1890s, we see the formation of things like arbitration and conciliation systems that became a feature of the Federation from 1901 onwards. We had the conciliation arbitration system. that led to things like the harvester decision and things like that. There was a lot of good that came out of these disputes in terms of how working people got themselves organised to have a bit more security.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet. www.3cr.org.au.
They used to go to London to get these loans. They go to London and they trade all the financial houses off against each other. And as part of the review of what the hell just happened when Melbourne plumped all this money into the London Dock Strike, they realised that's what was going on. And so what they did was they set up a single desk system for all Dominion loan ratings. So the Dominions were like Australia, New Zealand, Canada.
All the colonies.
Former colonies, the Dominions.
Mm.
And for all Dominion loan raisings, there would be this single desk, and it was this Robert Niverson and Son was the name of this one particular financial broker. And so any government would have to go first to them. He would just stroll around the streets of London and he'd walk in and say, we've got a loan raising for Victoria. You feel like taking, £1 million for that one? Okay, you can give us $1 million, okay. And they'd syndicalise the debt. But because you were dealing with a single desk, they could impose conditions. They could say, well, we don't like this policy, that policy, that policy, that policy, or that policy. So if you want this loan, we want you to fall into line with these things.
They're dictating government policy.
So that's what happened when Ted Theodore in Queensland went to England. So a delegation's gone ahead of him and said, don't give him anything to organise this financial blockade of Queensland in 1919. When Ted gets there, well, it was Robert Niverson and Son that he had to deal with then. They give him a list of demands. And so one of them was to kill off the employment policy.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
It was a Labor tactic, one that Ted Theodore used in Queensland during the war to deal with inflation, was that if there were businesses that you thought were price gouging, what you'd do is you'd set up a government business to act as a competitor. And so the Queensland government during the First World War operated butcher shops, pubs.
Oh my gosh.
And other businesses to act as a countervailing competitive
the
pressure.
The public option pub, Kev.
Yes, I'm liking the sound of this, the public option butcher.
Well, that's what the Commonwealth Bank was. The Commonwealth Bank was set up so that the government would have control over interest rates in terms of how much would be paid to depositors and how much would be charged on loans. And by the Commonwealth Bank having those margins, it forced the others into line with them through competitive pressure. That's why we had a government-owned Commonwealth Bank.
And can we just make explicit the monetary issue that's at stake here? Because what's going on then with Australia's monetary system? We didn't have the Australian dollar, is that right?
Well, we got the Australian pound, I think, around 1911 or something like that.
Okay. But why are they all needing to run off to England for money?
Well, the state governments had to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was an issue with if a lot of what you were buying had to be purchased in sterling because you were buying railway lines and railway engines and things like that from British manufacturers, you'd need to get sterling currency to buy it, and so you'd have to borrow from British banks for that. So in the First World War, we had to borrow from British manufacturers for the privilege of fighting the First World War for the British. We had to borrow £500 million off British bankers so that we could pay British manufacturers for uniforms, armaments.
We had to pay for the privilege of fighting in the war, and then at the end of the war, I guess we have this big debt to them.
We had the big debt, and that's what was happening in the 30s Depression, that after the First World War, Commonwealth was left with a debt to Britain that we had to pay back £28 million a year until 1965. That was the debt that we had. And in the 30s Depression, we were producing masses of wheat and wool and other commodities, but the prices had crashed. And so we were sending these mountains of stuff over to England and getting a pittance back. We weren't getting enough sterling currency back to meet the $28 million loan cost.
We were in the debt trap.
So the government, Scullin went over to England and to say, look, we don't want to default on this loan. You know, we want to be, you know, good upstanding types. We don't have that much in sterling currency, so we're going to have to borrow it. And the Bank of England and the Brits basically said, we'll only lend you the money if you cut your pensions, you cut public sector employment by 10%, pensions by 10%, and cut government spending across the board.
Typical austerity.
It was an austerity campaign.
Radio MMT.
Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev
at 3CR Community Radio, Melbourne, Australia.
Why did they want to do that? British bankers wanted the government to go onto the gold standard in 1926, and they wanted to set the exchange rate with the US dollar at the pre-war level to try and reclaim Britain's high standing in the world as this great financial source. And it meant that you had gold convertibility. So if someone's holding a mass of British pounds overseas and they don't really want to buy anything off Britain, they could go to the Bank of England and say, just give us the gold equivalent. So if the gold reserve then shrinks because you're handing it over to foreigners, under the gold standard, there was a formula that said something like of the currency in circulation, something like the equivalent of 25% of its value had to be covered by gold in gold reserves so that you could meet the requirements of the gold standard, which is at any time someone wants to exchange your currency for gold, they can do it. If that situation pertained, they'd have to shrink their currency in circulation, which would mean a massive recession.
For Britain.
Mm. So what they figured was that before we do this, it'd be better that we have the recession first so that we don't have that much demand in the economy. And so that's why they stacked on a recession in the early 1920s, that's why there was a massive recession in Britain and austerity, because they were trying to get themselves in a good position to go back onto the gold standard.
The thing to point out here too is just all these stories you're talking about is how this level of unemployment that they can create in these recessionary conditions, it's quite a fine-tuned lever. They can just press this thing up and down as they want through this capacity of the government.
Well, I mean, the way they do it in this country is they cut government employment and spending and they bung up the interest rates because You know, the interest rates is a popular one with governments these
We've
days.
We've noticed that recently.
Because poorer people are usually borrowers and therefore they're paying interest rates, and wealthy people are usually lenders, and so their income goes up while this austerity is being visited upon everyone else. Mm. So that's why interest rates are a particularly popular mechanism, because it's actually quite selective on who it
is. I always say it's class warfare when the RBA puts up interest rates.
Hmm. Hey, don't you remember? I'm your pal, buddy, can you spare a dime?
And under the gold standard, all of Britain's stuff was overpriced for foreigners. So the gist of it was that in any sort of trading arrangement with the gold standard set at the pre-war level, nobody was going to buy stuff off Britain, and stuff overseas was going to be really cheap for the British. So they had this terms of trade problem. So because the manufacturers in England were arcing up about this gold standard business, saying we're getting hammered, we're losing out in all these markets because the pound is overvalued. Mm. The bank said, you know, we're going to maintain the gold standard. You know, we like it because it makes us buckets of money. How about we help you get cheaper raw materials? And that's the point where Australia came in.
That's the little sacrificial lamb of Australia.
That was the depression we had to have, yeah, because where often it's presented that, you know, we told the story of the depression, it starts with the Wall Street crash. Mm. And, you know, the banking system fell apart. It's not really the case in Australia at all. Our situation was the commodity markets collapsed, you know, for wheat and wool and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that's because during the First World War, countries like Australia, Canada and Argentina increased their output of agricultural produce because Europe was taken out of the game because of the war. And then after the war, when European agriculture came back on stream again, the markets glutted. When the prices fell, countries like Australia made the foolish move to try to maintain income. They increased output. And so the markets glutted even more. So that created the first problem. The second problem was that the government, once elected, did not have the power to spend fiat currency because the board of the Commonwealth Bank refused to issue the money. Oh. The Senate blocked legislation that would have forced them to do it. And even though Theodore knew exactly how to reflate the economy. Mm. And effectively, the Second World War was proof positive of what he was arguing for. And that's why we had to have the Depression. It starts with the British bankers going back onto the gold standard. Of course, we went onto the gold standard on the same day with the Australian pound at the same level as the British pound. So we created all sorts of trade imbalance problems for ourselves by doing the same thing.
Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum.
Now Jacqueline, he defaulted on state debt.
He argued that, look, we shouldn't be paying this £28 billion during the middle of a depression. And he was particularly motivated to say it because the British had just got an amnesty for their debts to the United States.
Right, yeah.
And yet they wouldn't grant us an amnesty for our debts to them.
The hypocrisy.
A bit of hypocrisy, but the attitude was that if you didn't pay your debt, the interest rates on future loan raisings would be astronomical.
nobody would trust you. You'd be a high-risk customer, so yeah.
And there'd be a big loss of face. So Lyons, while he was still the treasurer in late 1930, Lyons railed against any suggestion of defaulting on the loan. And he led this campaign that was done all around Australia, that the J.B. Weir and Sons team backed him, organised all these meetings, and the Murdoch Press promoted it, where they issued bonds. There were going to be bonds issued so that people could, you know, chip in money to help pay for our British debt. And so this was an act of preserving Australia's honour. And so Lang was sort of denounced as, you know, a rat bag for suggesting that we should default.
And Lang at the time, what was he? Was the Premier.
He was the Premier of New South Wales, yeah. So Lang and Theodore were sort of faction enemies. So it was ultimately Lang's people that crossed the floor and brought down the Scullin government.
And Lang then, of course, went on to become Paul Keating's mentor. Well, Paul Keating visited him much like Bob Dylan visited Woody Guthrie, regarded him as an iconic legend.
And, you know, obviously he was a gifted politician.
So you mentioned earlier about how under Menzies every now and then they needed to slow down the economy so they would get up to 3% or more unemployment. And that makes me think of under the modern monetary theory idea of things, if you have to do that as the government, then what you ideally would have is a job guarantee for that 3%. So would you agree with that as a way of maintaining full employment?
Yeah, my view is that there should be a much bigger role played by the public sector in the economy generally in terms of bringing about all sorts of equity and improvements in social amenity, our hospitals, housing, transport systems. You know, there should be staff on railway stations so that it's safe to travel. Help people, elderly people onto the vehicle and all the rest of it. And look, I've done work over the years in areas like primary industries research, biosecurity, aged care. There's all these areas where if the public sector played a much larger role, you know, there's actually heaps of jobs to be done. And it would give people, you know, meaningful work to do, secure work, all the rest of it.
Whilst improving the public good, you know, making it a better place to live.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so you could get pretty close to full employment that way, but then there's always going to be a small sort of margin there that if you were to employ absolutely everybody, you're going to get into inflationary situations because to get that sort of looseness in the economy, you have to maintain a sort of a buffer stock because it expands and contracts the economy all the time. So the job guarantee model that Bill Mitchell and his colleagues around the world have sort of advocated for the better part of 30 years now strikes me as being a very clever device. So your standard public sector is employing the bulk of people who are not in the private sector, But then where there's a small margin of people who are not employed on that basis or who are just between jobs, then this idea of the job guarantee model means that you could give those people work and at least the federal minimum award wage, and it would not have an inflationary impact in doing so.
Mm.
And that's because it's fixed at the lowest wage that is legally permissible in the country, the federal minimum award wage. To have a fixed wage system that anybody can just walk into and immediately get a paid job, it would basically eliminate unemployment, but it would do so without triggering inflationary effects that arise when you have a very tight labour market. Because just to explain, if everybody's employed in normal jobs that pay full wages, whatever, if there's an employer that needs workers, they have to somehow lure those people out of those jobs. And the employers that want to retain those workers will put their wages up to hang on to them, even while another employer's offering more money to lure them out. And so you get this bidding process that bids up the price of labour. If you have a segment of the labour market that is fixed at the minimum wage, it means that any employer can bid that person out of that employment into their job with only a little bit more than the minimum wage as the lure.
So they're not competing against each other in a floating system. And if you have a government employment scheme that is paying, let's say it's paying 45, 50 grand a year, that by default would then become the minimum wage, because anybody who's working some sort of a job that's paying less than that is going to leave that to go and work for the government scheme.
Yeah, so eventually.
Personally, I know a lot of people who work in events and entertainment. That's an occupation which is often on and off. And so they'll have a gig. They might play in a band. They might be some work for their band, and then it stops. And in between, they go back to their NDIS work. It smooths out their income. So this is the sort of thing we're talking about with a job guarantee.
And it's not dissimilar to the way it used to operate when casual work on the railways, that if you want to just pick up a few quick bucks, you go down the rail yards and pick up a day's casual work here and there. You know, it's just that sort of flexibility. And the amount of people that might be in this job guarantee, that might vary depending on other factors in the economy, that you might only need a small pool or you might need a larger one depending on what you're managing in an economy. But the thing is, at the moment when we contract the economy, people are thrown out of their jobs, a lot of them are stuck with Job Seeker, and a lot of them don't even get onto that.
Job Seeker, which currently runs at about half the poverty level. So at the moment, there's a lot of economic turbulence going on. And like you say, people lose their job. They're perfectly capable of contributing and they want to. But due to circumstances beyond their control, they're thrown into a situation where they're at half the poverty level. That's fairly brutal.
And there's so many things, projects that we could have going on an ongoing basis. They're treated like intractable problems, when in fact, if you had a labour force that was dedicated to looking after it, you know, I'm thinking about elderly people trying to live in their homes, fixing up river systems and things like that, environmental work, invasive species control. I mean, it'd take an army of people to deal with some of these problems. But at the moment, we've got, I think it's about 1.5 million people who tell the Bureau of Statistics effectively on a monthly basis that they don't have work and they want to work.
There's your army.
There's your army. We count about 600,000 of them as unemployed, and we ignore, we don't count in the statistics, or we treat as having marginal attachment to the labour force, about 900,000 people. And some proportion of those are in receipt of income support, and others are living with relatives and getting by and bringing down everyone's disposable income around them. And it just seems to me that we could be doing so much better in terms of improving just how well the society functions. We often look at the Scandinavian countries and think, you know, it's remarkable how they seem to be able to do things really well. And there doesn't seem to be really that much difficulty with doing it other than having the intent.
Yeah, so we've seen the reasons to have full employment is just to create that better society that you're talking about, with what I sum up as universal basic services and, you know, a decent standard of living. And then we've also got the reason that you want full employment from the other side is to avoid the slide into fascism and so on. So it's so worth looking back at the history to understand where we are now with full employment and why we would still want it, and why it's not a snooze issue. It's actually vital to all of our well-being. So I really appreciate you coming back again to Radio MMT, Victor.
Anytime.
Very, very much enjoyed your insights and your knowledge of history. It's always very interesting, Victor.
Thank you. Great to see you both.
That was Dr. Victor Quirk, labour market political sociologist, telling us the sad and sorry history of governments deliberately creating unemployment in Australia. And, you know, I think of the politics of full employment. They're basically the politics of why some people want to keep other people in poverty.
It's amazing how, you know, we've been looking at this in a post-World War II framework. You know, we have the 45 to 75 years, which were Keynesian years, and then we have the neoliberal era since then. But it's history repeating itself just time and time again. And what we see is conditions that are described as just cyclical, natural.
Yes.
Sometimes there's work and sometimes there's not. But what we're seeing is that it's money, it's capital coordinating with government to create conditions that keep workers under control of capital, you know, and capital is quite willing to take some short-term hits because it has a long-term strategy to discipline labour to do what they're told. And they don't want to lose that control, and they're happy to work with government. And these days, even the Labour government, who succumbed to things like the Nauru and should know better. We were talking before about Jim Chalmers. He's an intelligent guy. These people must know, but they won't even engage in the conversation. And so we see just a consistency of exploitation of workers so that capital can maintain their profit margins.
Yeah, you can definitely see the vice-like grip that capital has on our political and economic system. And I used to think, well, I couldn't get more shocked after hearing that governments deliberately create unemployment. And then possibly what shocked me even more in what Victor was saying is how England was applying the colonial playbook to Australia. So the idea there is you get a country into debt in your own currency that the other country doesn't produce.
Yep.
And then you can get them to sell you resources at a cheap price because they're trying to get that currency to pay you back. And then when they still have trouble paying back the debt, then you can force austerity on them.
Yeah, and this is being done in the 1880s, 1890s. And yet we see the IMF roll out the same playbook post-World War II with developing countries.
Yes, it's the global north does it to the global south all the time. So I shouldn't have been that shocked. But I think I've lost any lingering sentimentality about Britain as the mother country.
Yeah, yeah. Just
like we're deliberately not taught. We're deliberately kept in the dark about these things. You know, we can't learn from history if we don't know history.
That's right. So people like Victor are just so invaluable because they've really figured out what was going on. And, you know, the thing is about this feature of capitalism that they need unemployment to keep workers under the thumb. One of the things that they're doing is that they're fueling this myth that people wouldn't work unless they were motivated by fear of unemployment, right? And I don't know, I have a more optimistic view of humanity. I think the vast majority of people, we are motivated by a desire to contribute. And I sort of imagine, oh, we could have a much more humane and functional, and I would call it an eco-socialist society, and we could meet all of our material needs by workers who are working and motivated by things like curiosity, like I think of scientists being curious about things, or you could be motivated by a sense of responsibility to other people in care work, or you can be motivated simply like by a desire for belonging and acceptance. I don't think they need the big stick.
It's the definition of human behaviour by this conservative kind of ideology, which is classist in its inception. Workers are there to be exploited. I mean, if you're driven by profit, you're looking for exploitation. You can only make profit through exploitation, which is to gain surplus value for yourself. And that's done via exploitation of...
That's the distinction, isn't it? So you do need the fear of unemployment if you want to exploit someone.
Yeah.
If you just want them to work and contribute, then you don't need that.
And so their definition of human nature is this kind of exploitative, competitive definition, the rational actor who's going to always seek to maximise their position.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really pretty... I think it flies in the face of people... need to feel socially connected, and they need to feel useful. And so it's not about maximising your your personal return. It's about how you fit into society. That's human nature. And this is where capitalism falls over. But we got to go.
We've got to go.
We've got Mafalda coming up next with Vicky. See you later.
See you then.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/Radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTed.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalence, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.